I had to put on a facade. I had to learn to kind of live a double life where it's like you have your straight passing self where you're trying to convince a group of people, your family or people at church or your friends or whatever, that you're straight and that everything is normal and whatever. And then there's this other side of you that you know is like the real you. So there's this incredible torment happening inside of my body and my brain.
Hi, everyone. This is Dana Black.
And this is Chelsea Simon.
Welcome to the collective table.
Chelsea here. Today's podcast feels like three friends sitting around chatting about theology, faith, and life. Dana and I had never met Aaron Green before, but instantly felt like kindred spirits. Aaron is an affirming biblical scholar and LGBTQ+ activist. Their passion is helping those excluded by the church to heal from spiritual abuse and trauma by navigating the biblical text in restorative ways. Aaron is best known for their work in supporting LGBTQ+ students on conservative Christian university campuses. They served as the co-executive director of Brave Commons, a queer-led group seeking to dismantle oppressive systems at Christian universities and address the denial of basic human rights of LGBTQ+ students. Aaron currently works with the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. Through civil rights litigation, documentary film, oral history, research, and public policy, REAP works towards a world where LGBTQ+ students on all campuses are treated equally with safety and respect. This conversation was warm, honest, funny, and deeply meaningful. We hope you enjoyed as much as we did.
Well, we kind of start every conversation with just tell us a little bit about your background, particularly faith and church and kind of what that looked like as you were growing up.
So I grew up in an evangelical church and went with my parents every Sunday. And then, you know, I started to realize at a certain time in my life that I was not straight. And that started to really conflict with my faith. And the thing about like my personal interaction with faith was I loved God so much and I loved the Bible so much. And I just wanted to figure this out. And I had tremendous internalized homophobia for such a long time and was really wrestling with these components and trying to make them work together somehow. I believed at one point in my life that these things didn't work out. So what I did was I escaped into my internalized homophobia and dove straight into abusing alcohol and drugs. And that was the way I coped with my homophobia or internalized homophobia. And then I realized, well, that's not working either. This isn't a solution. It's not solving anything. And I decided to go back to school and I switched to the PCUSA denomination where they were open and accepting and inclusive. There's a bigger, longer story that goes with that. But that was the first time in my life that I was affirmed by anybody, like a member of clergy in a church as a queer person. So it took a long time. That was in my 30s. I was 32 when that happened. So I went my whole teenage years through my 20s into my 30s, finally came out in my 30s.
So during those teenage and 20s, were you connected to the church or were you just kind of like, I can't do that right now?
I felt so disconnected. I mean, I was there, but I felt invisible. You know, I really felt like, so I was there, but nobody would see me or nobody could see me. And I couldn't really be who I was. I had to put on a facade. That's sort of the thing that happens, or at least with me. I don't want to speak for other queer people, but we almost learn, or I had to learn to kind of live a double life where it's like you have your straight passing self where you're trying to convince a group of people, your family or people at church or your friends or whatever, that you're straight and that everything is normal and whatever. And then there's this other side of you that you know is like the real you. So there's this incredible torment happening inside of my body and my brain. But I felt very disconnected from the church body and didn't feel connected again until I was able to come out at that Presbyterian church. And then I felt like, oh, these people actually see me for who I am and love me and accept me for who I am. And that was the first time I had ever experienced anything like that. And it was wonderful.
So what kept you engaged? I mean, when I hear the words that you use, a part of me, I can imagine I would just be like, okay, I'm done. I'm done with Christianity. This is, you know, how did you stay engaged?
I stayed engaged. I get asked this a lot. I stayed engaged because I'm not going to let anybody tell me that I can't have a faith. I'm not going to let any church or anybody tell me that I can't take part in what I was reading from the text. Because what I was reading was, you are invited, you are included, you are loved, you are a beloved child of God. And I was included in that. And I wasn't going to let anybody rob me of that narrative in my life. So I said, no, no, this is not okay. And that's why I went back to school for biblical studies and to get my MDiv, was to, you know, solidify that knowledge that I had like deep within my heart and my soul. And so that I could impart that onto other people who experience what I have.
I work with a small group of young adults who are LGBTQ, and they had similar experience. Like they couldn't be them full selves in church. And then they also didn't want to be Christian out in the world because their friends who were also LGBT have this vision of the church. It's kind of like your experience with the press when you were told by clergy that you were loved, like this reckoning of like, oh, these two things do go together and I can be affirmed in this. Like, they just need to hear more voices like that.
Yeah. And there are voices like ours. I'm not like as connected to the church as I feel like I used to be. And my vision or my ideas about church have changed since being in seminary and since being in school. But I realize that there's something revolutionary that we can be doing that doesn't necessarily have to happen inside the four walls of a church. And we need to look at that more deeply and ask ourselves, you know, what really constitutes church? And is it this institutionalized vision of the church, or is it something much deeper and radical than we've ever imagined? I err on the side of it can be radical. And
like
we're
that.
With you. We're with you.
Yeah, we're with you.
It takes so much courage to be in your teens and 20s and having this institution tell you that you are wrong in who you are. It takes so much courage to be like, you're not going to kick me out. I'm going to be here and I'm going to be who I am. But like, you had to have gone through a shift at some point. Like, your theology had to have like, so what was that like for you? And how did that happen?
For me, one of the biggest part of the text that I wrestled with was Romans chapter 1. And that was like, okay, if I can mentally exegete this text and if I can understand it, then this to me shatters all the other ones. And then understand just like my knowledge in biblical studies that some of the Pauline texts are not actually written by Paul. This is a very important piece of information that they don't tell us in an evangelical church. So I must have read Romans 1 hundreds of times, hundreds and hundreds of times. And I kept reading it and I'm like, this is not what this text is saying. And thinking like, this is not who I am.
For our listeners at home, what does Romans 1 say?
Well, it says a lot. That's kind of the problem. But there's a main verse that says, you know, men will exchange the natural for the unnatural and burn in lust for other men. That's something along those lines. And the women do the same thing. But before that verse happens, there is a lot that happens way before that. And it's a clear series of exchanges that go on. And the problem is idolatry. The problem is excessiveness and indulgence. The problem is not being queer. And it's actually, it could be talking about straight people who are already in marriages. And they are going beyond the marriage into, you know, excessive indulgence sexually or physically or like whatever. And this was, I mean, in antiquity, to lose control of the body was frowned upon in Greco-Roman society. Now, so that's part of it. But knowing all this, I'm like, this is not talking about me. And this is not talking about my queer friends. You know, and it likens this behavior to murder and other vices. And I'm like, I'm not a murderer. I'm not any of these things. This is not related to who I am. So I had to ask myself, like, what is it talking about?
So many people in the church don't understand the context of any particular biblical passage, where we call it, you know, we're exegeting the text. We're really trying to dig into what was going on, what was just taking one little verse and being like, boom. No, it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. Yeah. You can't just splice out a little section and then wrap your whole ideology around that or, you know, group it in with a bunch of other texts that allegedly say the same things. Right. That's not how, well, I mean, if as a biblical studies scholar, that's not how it works. So I mean, I know that, but other people, you know, people outside of biblical studies or scholarship don't know that. And so they're just grouping all these things together and saying, see, this is what this says. And it's like, well, wait a minute. We literally have to pick each text apart and where, you know, leave them where they stand in the text that they stand in.
One of the questions I have as we're going, so I'm actually at Duke Divinity right now in their hybrid program. And I've tried to understand, like, I think you started at Biola, you moved to Azusa Pacific. And again, Duke Divinity is a progressive community. That's how we're interpreting the Bible. It is, we're looking at context. We're talking about the literary devices. We're talking about the time period. We're talking about the entire letter of Paul, not like what was the overall intent. What is there a have you found a difference in some of these other more conservative theological schools? Like what does that look like?
Well, that's why I left Biola because Biola did have a problem with not objectively looking at the text. They had an agenda, you know, kind of a preconceived agenda, especially in their school of theology. So, and while I was there, I was also in charge of Biolan's Equal Ground, which was an underground LGBTQ group, and everybody knew I was the leader. So I was leading protests on campus. So there was a bias already set against me as like, okay, that queer person who's also in our biblical studies program. One of the funny things at Biola was that they would use only other Biola professors' books as required reading in classes. So it was a very incestual, like, yeah. Academic situation. Azusa Pacific was very different. They had much more liberal and progressive professors in their department of theology, and they did not do that. So I got a much better, like, biblical education at Azusa Pacific than I think I would have at Biola.
What advice would you have to someone who was just, you know, not going to go get a biblical scholarship, you know, dive in deep? Like, how would you suggest people to read the Bible or look at texts in a way that can be more expansive, more accurate?
Yeah, that's a great question. I hate to say this, but I would say maybe stop going to that church, or feel free to question your pastor. There should not be a power dynamic between a pastor and their congregation. That just shouldn't exist. And that's one of the biggest problems I have with the church structure as it stands right now, like even in the Presbyterian church. But anyway, I digress. So there are a ton of resources, like other books and things like that, that a queer person can read, and it's really brought down to their level like if they're not in academia or something like that. There's a great book called Bible Gender Sexuality by Dr. James Brownson that breaks down literally all of the clobber texts. And it's probably the best, like the one I would recommend above any other text to someone who would be questioning that for themselves.
That's great.
That's great. And one of the other things I've learned going through this process at Duke Divinity is I've invested in both the Queer Bible Commentary and the Woman's Bible Commentary, along with some other commentaries. But having and it's something that I don't think commentary is for some reason I've been United Methodist my entire life. Nobody ever said, hey, Dana, get some commentary when you're reading biblical passages. And yet we should all be doing that.
Yes. And that's the thing is like, so in a situation like that, I hope that the pastor, or I hope that other members of the congregation would encourage some kind of study group. Like, hey, let's go through these texts together and have the pastor be a part of that, or the other pastors who are on the team, and really go into it with a mindset of we're going to hash this out, and there's going to be arguments, there's going to be debates, but we're going to argue through this or talk through this or think through this. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with wrestling with or chewing on an idea because people's lives are at stake. Like, that's what it comes down to. So we ought to be doing this work, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think our minimum requirement is to understand what we're professing with our dollars and our votes and the ways we live our life. Like, at minimum, we should be really trying to understand. And I always think wrestling is like real participation. It's not just like this black and white thing. It's like, I'm really going to get in there and try to understand this for myself. And it's, I think so many people think it's bad to like wrestle or question, or I think we've been taught that. I've been taught that.
Yeah, it's like it's sort of demonized, like when we don't know the direct answer. Like sometimes we don't have to know exactly like what the answer is. Like we can still have these discussions and ask ourselves, like, is this the most loving way that we can treat somebody else? Like, that's a good question to ask, you know. Things like that. But you're absolutely right. Yeah.
I wanted to then talk more, try to get into, so how do you get involved with Brave Commons, going back to colleges, because this was what Brave Commons was created for.
I just met Michael Vasquez, who was doing the same work that I was doing, but in the Midwest and at other Christian colleges. And then we also had another friend, Lauren Sotolongo, who went to Azusa Pacific, and we kind of all just knew what it was like to be an activist at these private Christian schools and to be queer. So we decided, hey, let's do this, but let's do this at all the schools in the United States, because we really wanted to especially touch upon schools in the South and the Midwest, where they had much more stringent policies. And just it's a nightmare for some of these students, depending on where they're at. So we did a lot of grassroots stuff, you know, without any money. We did a lot of work. And I mean, we were trying to, yeah, get funded and trying to get a fiscal sponsor and things like that. But it just didn't work out, but we did a lot of work, you know.
Did you go into the college? How did you approach? So I just have to, you know. So my oldest son graduated from Baylor.
Oh, okay, cool.
And so, and it was, you know, I've wrestled and struggled with the theology, as it is more conservative, and it's, you know, do you go into Baylor? Do you go into some of these? What were you trying to do?
Well, we were helping students remotely. They would contact us and they would say, hey, you know, I want to start a group on campus, and I'm the only queer person that I know of here. There was literally one student who came up to me at the Q Christian conference and said, this is what I want to do. So I helped them, and eventually that one person became two people. And then those two people became 10 people. And then those 10 people became 20 people. And so we were just helping them, or like we'd be on phone calls or Zoom calls and like trying to help them strategize as much as possible with like how to negotiate with administration, how to have conversations with administration, and how to organize and galvanize other people. So we weren't necessarily like, well, I was doing my own work at Azusa Pacific trying to change a policy there. And in the meantime, we were, you know, on the phone just talking to as many students as we could to help them organize from afar.
Got it. So really just trying to help them say, okay, you're at this school, let me tell you what we've been doing at our places. And, you know, what do you want to change? How do you want to communicate with the administration? How do you want to approach them? How do you want to get others involved and engaged in the work?
Yeah. And we would definitely also recognize and give those groups autonomy, because like each school is different, each group is different, and they have different needs. So it wasn't like we created a Brave Commons way. We didn't really do that. We were trying to maximize their situations, like maximize the benefits that they would have wherever that they were at.
So you were basically helping them, give them the tools to do their own work.
Exactly. That was the goal.
Was the focus on policy change, or was it really, or was a part of it to kind of what you were talking about earlier, to create these safe spaces where people could come and rest, like, have their own small groups on campus that they could kind of have community?
Yeah. So it depended on the school. For Azusa Pacific, the task at hand was a policy change. They were ready for a policy change. And we changed the policy. But at another school, the need might be different. It might be very basic. Like, we just need a group together. We just need a safe space, like you said. And it just depended upon the needs of any specific or any given location, because it was so different. The needs were so different based on location.
I can't imagine being on a college campus with like a ton of people and feeling like I'm the only one, and then having to start to move somewhere or do something that I have no idea how to do it. Like, I don't even know what questions to ask. And on top of that, then you're dealing with like all of your own internal, you know, struggles and identity issues, and just a lot for a college person to handle.
That's why this is the problem on these campuses, that the non-affirming language of policies, like you cannot be who you are on this campus, or you are not allowed to date someone of the same sex or whatever. This creates a learning environment of isolation, depression, anxiety. Someone like that is more prone to drug and alcohol abuse. They're more prone to suicidal ideation. So this is why these policies are so harmful. And that makes it extra hard for one student to come out and say, we've got to do something about this.
And at such a delicate age, because if I'm correct, and I'm not going to start spitting off statistics, but that age in college, the brain is continuing to form and develop. And researchers are now seeing that kids are in college are experiencing depression, anxiety, suicidal issues with all kinds of related trauma. And then adding that, you know, and this here, right here is a trauma that we don't have to have.
Exactly. It's avoidable. That's the thing. And you'd think that a Christian institution would want to avoid placing that kind of burden onto its students, but no, you know, that's not what they're doing. They're doing the opposite. But yeah, it's a critical age. And sometimes, I mean, the biggest question I get asked is, why are these queer students at private Christian universities? And it's the question that frustrates me the most, because I can give you a plethora of reasons why someone would wind up in this space through no fault of their own. And one of the things you touched upon, Dana, was that sometimes people don't even discover that they're queer until they're already in this space. And then it's like, whoa, now what do I do? I have family that will not affirm me, friends that won't affirm me. You know, you're alone, you're isolated, you've got to find someone like you. Like, it's so difficult and so challenging.
will Brave Commons continue to exist? So if students want to connect with someone, that it is, it will be available. It's just not going to be, as you said, you know, given funding issues, as active as it could be if there was more funding.
Right. Yes, I would say that we will always be there to assist students. But at, you know, could we do it at a fuller capacity? Sure, if we had the funding, but we just, yeah. So we are limited. But that's a cool thing, though, about this organization that I will be working for is they do have the funding. So leading people, you know, who might seek out help through Brave Commons, we can give them this resource at REAP, which is the new organization that I'll be working for. And they'll have a lot more power, you know, and be able to use that power.
Can you tell us a little bit about, is it REAP, R-E-E-P?
It's REAP, R-E-A-P, and it stands for Religious Exemption Accountability Project. So what the mainstay of REAP is going after Title IX exemptions that exist on private Christian university campuses. So they have a couple of different strategies. They filed this lawsuit against the Department of Education. But we're also looking at helping other students at campuses to learn how to file their own Title IX complaints and to file accreditation complaints. There's all sorts of ways that queer students can protect themselves in these environments. And that's basically part of what we're teaching them and showing them how to do. So a lot of what I've been doing at Brave Commons will actually happen at REAP. That's one of the reasons why I think they wanted my help there.
We'll make sure to put a link in just for anybody that's listening that might really be able to use that. I mean, or know someone. I think we were saying it is such an isolating experience, and to really yes. recognize that there are organizations and people there to support. I think kind of in your experience too, it can be life-saving.
It really can. Yes. Life-saving is key. Cause like I said, the isolation can really ruin someone's life, you know? It really can.
I wonder if you can share a little bit about the story when you were finally at a church that you were affirmed.
It started out with a professor I had who was a retired Presbyterian minister. And I did things backwards in my life. So when I graduated high school, I worked for like 14 years. I had a career in fashion and retail, and then I resigned. I didn't want to get pigeonholed into that industry. And I thought, well, I need to do something now if I'm going to do something different. So I went back to school and I had to start at a junior college because I had no, you know, that's what I had to do. At this random junior college, there just so happened to be a class on philosophy of Old and New Testament. And I thought, oh my God, I've got to take these classes. Well, the man teaching them was a retired Presbyterian minister. And he and I developed an academic relationship and I came out to him. He was one of the first people I had ever come out to. And he was like, oh, well, you have to be in biblical studies. You have to do this. You have to go all the way with this. And then he's like, and then you should go to the Presbyterian Church because the PCUSA denomination is open and affirming and welcoming. So
he was very formative.
He's still my academic mentor. I mean, it's funny because I talked to him the other day. So for him to see me start out at like the first class in undergrad to getting my biblical studies degree, then to getting my MDiv. Like he's watched me go through this whole process. and it's been wonderful to have him by my side through this whole thing. But it was so different and weird to have people love you just for who you are. You know, it's like this exists and everybody deserves to have this in their life. It was wonderful and beautiful, and it'll be you know, especially that experience with that professor will be something I will just never forget. Ever.
Because I want our listeners that are on the cusp of giving up on faith or church or whatever, to hear stories of other ways, that there are other ways. And even what you're saying, maybe it isn't a four walls church structure. Maybe it is this other way. But people to hear stories of there's something else. There's something better.
I think anything can be church. I really do. You can have brunch with some friends and maybe within that brunch time have a theological discussion, and that is church. We were having a going away party for one of my friends here at the seminary, and there were a ton of us at this party, and we were all having a wonderful time. It was the Sunday of Pentecost. And we were all drinking and eating and laughing and having an incredibly amazing time. And my friend mentioned, he's like, this is like Pentecost. But we were just outside enjoying each other, enjoying our relationships and our friendships, enjoying the food, enjoying the drinks, and like really embracing the gifts that God has given to us. So I think part of it is mindfulness. It's like every single thing that I do can be an act of worship. Like I don't have to demonize material things. I just preached a sermon actually yesterday on how in Ecclesiastes, God says, like, I approve of what you do. I approve, like, eat this bread, drink your wine. For long ago, I approved what you do. And so envisioning just like going through the motions of life beyond the church, like that is worship. That is church. And that's a way to bring people who don't go to church into the church, you know, in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, Brother Lawrence has this great idea about washing dishes as an act of worship. And I loved that it's just so intentional about what you're already doing is blessed and good and connected.
And I think you just embody worship all the time. And and it comes out. Right. Why not? And then people are seeing it come to life where it should be. It should be coming to life.
Yeah. And when we look at what Jesus was doing, most of the work that was happening was not in the temple.
No.
It was outside. It was traveling. It was, you know, engaging with people. It was
having dinner around tables.
I was like eating and drinking, right?
Eating and drinking.
So why can't we really like evolve into that? Like, so that's sort of where my head is at for someone who is on the cusp of leaving. Like I would say, don't give up, because literally like your whole life is a response and worship to God. And like you are pleasing to God just in the little tiny things that you do, you know? And those can be considered communication with God. So that's what I believe. Yeah.
You know, just a couple of weeks ago, Dana and our senior pastor baptized my youngest at the beach. And I was like, why do I have to do this at the beach? And it was like my reminder that God is everywhere and not contained to the four walls of the church. But I mean, we go down to the beach and it's like, of course God is here. Where else would God be? You know, like
God was loud and roaring up the waves. I mean, it just washing right up on us. Yes. It was wonderful. Yeah.
Literally. Yeah.
Like the most natural baptismal font ever. Just go to the beach.
Like whenever we say, what would Jesus do? It's just like, what would Jesus, like we need to get back to what actually Jesus would do, or like, you know, baptized in the river and eating and drinking with friends and traveling. And
right. That's exactly. Yes. I think that's what it's all about. So it's like really, truly embracing like our bodies, our minds, our feelings, our emotions, and our experiences. And these are things that within, I have a fly flying around right now and it's distracting me. these are the things that are often demonized in the church, you know, like feelings, emotions, experiences, and that kind of
stuff. I saw that fly.
That's huge.
Are you preaching at different churches or online?
So I preach at a church. Like on their online worship service yesterday. So I, even though I'm not ordained, like people still randomly will ask me to preach. So, and I will take those opportunities. I just have no desire to be ordained. But yeah, so I mean, occasionally someone might, you know, get wild and want me to preach at their church, which is fine. I'm down.
I would love it. That Ecclesiastes, I felt like I was at church when you were just talking about that. Yeah. I was like,
one of the other things that we wanted to ask you was about Bible Query. It's another avenue of your work. And so we wanted to talk about it.
Bible Query. During COVID, my friend Rachel and I were like, we've got to do something on Instagram Live because people have questions about the Bible. And one of the biggest things that we wanted to do was take the loftiness of academia out of academia and bring it to folks who don't go to seminary. So that is what Bible Query does. And we have like a workshop we've gone through one cycle of. It was like I think it was 10 weeks. It will not be that long next time, but we went through each week. We had a curriculum basically that we went through. A lot of those pieces, like the three of us have just discussed, like emotions, feelings, storytelling. We went through clobber texts and things like that. And just, we had a big group of people who wanted to learn all these things who don't have access to seminary resources. So it's actually a project that we're really passionate about like keeping it going.
Does it focus on the LGBTQ community or is it for whoever?
No, yes. And in a sense, I think we prioritize the queer community, but it's open to people who do not identify as queer because we want to, I mean, like I said, we would prioritize queer folk, but we definitely want to make these resources accessible to allies as well. So I'm trying to think if we had any allies in the last group. I think everybody was queer, but yeah, it's something that we're kind of still expanding on and experimenting with and thinking about, but it was really a successful first run that I was very pleased with.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea and it's very needed. Yeah, absolutely.
That's one of our focuses too, is that how do we make this accessible?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it can be just so lofty and so, it's so complicated, but
yeah,
how do you be honest, but accessible?
Right. And we, you know, we taught them things like, what does exegesis and eisegesis mean? What does hermeneutics even mean? You know, and how does that apply to my interpretation of the biblical text or whatever? And we did a very basic thing on that, but they learned things that we learned in seminary that not necessarily many churches would teach to them, you know? So that is what we wanted to do, is kind of make it more, just as accessible.
Yeah. I think another area that I have found passion with is Christian history, because I know for me, like, I took a Christian history class last semester and I'm like, wait, what? I mean, I did not know.
Yes, it's wild.
It's wild. It is totally wild. Yeah. And I mean, even yesterday when I was talking about the Trinity, people are like, it's not, the word Trinity is not in the Bible. I'm like, yeah, no, it was created in like, it didn't even come into until 325 AD. And then they still argued about it for several more centuries. And they're like, Oh my, what? You know?
Yeah. It's crazy. Oh yeah. There's a lot of words and things and phrases that people use that are not in the biblical text at all. And I'm just like, what? Yeah. So yeah. No, it's great stuff for people to learn. Yeah. And I didn't ever get that kind of training or teaching in a church. So Rachel and I thought, well, let's, you know, we're both in seminary. Let's make what we're learning in seminary accessible to queer folk.
That's awesome. I have a couple of people in mind. I'm like, okay, I think they'd be into it.
Yeah,
like,
let us know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're kind of coming to the end of our time, but you're doing so much and have so many big plans in your future, it sounds like. We're so excited to watch and really participate. But What continues to fuel you with hope and drive to do the work? Because it can be a lot. It can burn you out.
I leave space for things to be what they are and what they will become. And I'm very excited about what this will become. Like this work that I'm doing with Rachel, with Bible Query, the work that I've been doing in academics, the work that I'll be doing with REAP. So I have a hope that we can radicalize what church experience is like, especially in the way that we discussed it. I have a hope for the way that church can evolve and the way that it can be revolutionized to truly embrace and include everybody.
What is your vision of what church could or should or can be as you're talking about like this unraveling and unveiling?
Yeah. So I think church should look like a discussion between everybody. I don't love that someone stands in the pulpit and teaches and then people fellowship for a little bit afterward and have a coffee or something like that. I envision like people who have access to academic resources and whatever, just having discussions with their congregants, like having like a large table and having a meal, you know? So that's sort of how I envision what church is like without a power dynamic, without hierarchy, without anything like that.
That would be wonderful.
I think it would be fun. Like I know it's not, I don't know if it's realistic, but it's like, I would love for people to participate in the dialogue of a sermon.
Yeah. We do, Dana and I do, or we've done and are starting to do again, the dinner church model where you kind of come to dinner and have drinks and just kind of really, someone presents something, but it's, okay, what do you think? Like, what does that mean for you? Kind of thing. So
that's what it should be, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll let you know how it starts going.
Yeah, let me know. And I would love to participate if I'm ever down in the area. So
yes, please call us. We're totally online, but we're moving back into, we were like a church start that COVID knocked out right from the beginning.
Oh,
so
no.
We were like working for a year, gathering, you know, a community and stuff. And then COVID hit and we were like,
right
before we even had our first service. So trying to reimagine what that's going to look like. But yeah, if you're down here, call us. We would love to.
I would love to hang. I'm vaccinated and I would love to hang out and even to join in on a church Zoom thing.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This was like such a, we were saying earlier, you know, some people take a while to get warmed up, but Aaron just jumped right in. And it was really a great conversation. Like it was so fun. And there was so much I learned in our brief time together. So I know our audience is going to just be so blessed by hearing.
Good.
So thank you.
100%. Yeah, I had a blast. Thank you. I love this discussion.
Bye.
Thank you for making it so wonderful. And it was great to finally see y'all on the Zoom. And yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And we'll see you soon. We'll see you at some point in person. I have no doubt.
Yes. I agree with this. We're going to make this happen.
Absolutely.
We will. Okay.
All right. Thanks,
Bye,
Aaron.
Thank you. Bye, y'all.
Thank you so much for listening. Just like everyone we are interviewing throughout this series reflects the sacred and holy image of God, so do you. Together, we are what God looks like.
The Collective Table is supported by San Diego United Methodist Church in Encinitas, California.
A big thank you to the team at Castos, especially our producer Stuart Barefoot and our content editor Claire Watson.
The original music heard in this episode was created and performed by Mystic Mercy.
Make sure to subscribe to the podcast, YouTube channel, and our newsletter.
If you'd like to financially support the work of The Collective Table, please visit thecollectivetable.org. There you can also find out more about who we are and view past episodes.